web at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Technological Nightmares, a lecture by renowned economist Professor Paul Streeton on the perils of technological development.
The threat of an atomic eclipse, which was common in the 20th century, has now been replaced by the fear of unstoppable human-engineered viruses, rampaging mutant genes, etc.
Professor Emeritus Paul Streeton on the ways that technological progress can lead to unintended consequences. That's tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The wildfires roaring through parts of Southern California are now being blamed for at least 11 deaths, all in the San Diego area. The blazes have destroyed some 500 homes and are threatening thousands more. Entire towns have been evacuated, as has a Federal Aviation Administration control center. That is causing long delays for flights bound for Los Angeles and San Diego. And now a number of airlines, including Southwest, America West, and United, are canceling flights into and out of the region for the rest of the day. For member station KCRW, Eric Roy has more.
Two of the worst fires started in the San Bernardino area, about 50 miles east of Los Angeles. The Grand Prix fire that swept out of the mountains Friday has blackened at least 35,000 acres and has crossed into Los Angeles County's suburban San Gabriel Valley. Radio host Brian Sanders lives on nearby Mount Baldy. He and his wife made a midnight dash down the mountain.
Flames were on both sides of the road. There were sparks shooting across the road. And it was pretty scary.
To the east, a fire that's blackened at least 12,000 acres after starting in a foothill canyon is raging out of control in the city of San Bernardino, where it threatens 1,000 homes. It's also burning uphill toward the mountain resort of Lake Arrowhead, where hundreds of thousands of trees left dead by bark beetles pose a historic fire threat. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
California Governor Gray Davis has directed the National Guard to provide helicopters to fire crews and cots for emergency shelters. Davis spoke to people at an evacuation center in San Bernardino.
This is a terrible situation. These are the worst fires we've faced in California in 10 years. And I want you to know that I'm mobilizing every available resource to combat these fires.
Davis has asked President Bush to declare several counties in California federal disaster areas to open the way for government assistance. 8 to 10 rockets fired early this morning from a homemade launch device slammed into the Baghdad hotel housing the U.S. occupation authority for Iraq. An American colonel was killed and 17 other people were wounded. A top Defense Department official was among those who rushed out of the building and took cover, as NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Baghdad.
The improvised missile launcher used in this morning's attack is a bright blue metal box that looks like an electric generator. Brigadier General Martin Dempsey, commander of the 1st Armored Division, whose area of control is Baghdad, says attackers placed the device about a half mile from the hotel. The firing was by an automatic timer. 40 missiles were prepared for launch, but only 8 to 10 fired and hit the hotel. General Dempsey said the attack required rehearsal, surveillance, and planning over a couple of months. The missile launcher itself was booby-trapped and had to be defused before U.S. military experts could examine it. An investigation into the incident is underway. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Baghdad.
This is NPR News.
Good evening. I'm Steve Brown in Boston. There's talk on Beacon Hill of giving Bay State shoppers a couple of sales tax-free days. Senate President Robert Travellini is spearheading the move to provide one tax-free day during the Christmas holiday season, as well as another tax-free day in the spring. The plan is part of an economic stimulus package that is to be unveiled in the next few weeks. The latest poll of the Democratic presidential candidates in New Hampshire shows Howard Dean expanding his lead over John Kerry. The Boston Globe Channel 4 poll gives Dean a 13-point edge over Kerry. Meanwhile, a major TV debate of the candidates in New Hampshire is in jeopardy. Four candidates say they will bypass the event should videographers from a New Hampshire TV station not get a new contract. The photographers asked the candidates to boycott the debate should an agreement not be reached. It's 9:05. It'll be windy with clouds and showers tonight. Temperatures will drop into the mid-50s. Strong winds from the southwest will make it feel a little bit cooler. Clouds, wind, and rain tomorrow. The rain may be heavy at times with highs in the mid-60s. There may be some thunderstorms late in the day into Monday night. Mostly cloudy with some drizzle or light rain to start the day on Tuesday, but then the sun will break through in the afternoon. Highs will reach in the mid to upper 50s. Wednesday, more clouds than sunshine with the risk of a few showers. Highs will be in the low 60s. Right now, 59 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. MathWorks.com. By the Cancer Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, a founding member of the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center, online at bidmc.harvard.edu. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org. Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we have the second of two lectures, together entitled Technological Nightmares, recently given by renowned economist Professor Paul Streeton. Professor Streeton is the founding chairman of the editorial board of World Development, a monthly journal exploring ways of improving standards of living. Throughout his career, he has worked with several UN bodies, including the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and UNESCO. He is currently a visiting professor of future studies at the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. In tonight's lecture, Professor Streeton will examine six technological nightmares in detail. Professor Streeton is introduced by Pardee Center Director David Fromkin.
Good evening. My name is David Fromkin, and as Director of the Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future, I welcome you to our 2003 Distinguished Lecture Series. This evening, we will hear the second and concluding lecture by our Pardee visiting professor, Dr. Paul Streeton, formerly professor and now professor emeritus in the Department of Economics here at Boston University. Dr. Streeton continues to work actively with various of the institutions of the United Nations in his field of social and economic development. Dr. Streeton is and has been for a long time the world's leading authority.
Thank you, Professor Fromkin, and ladies and gentlemen. At the end of last week's lecture, I briefly discussed the first of my concerns, or nightmares, or whatever you like to call them, which dealt with the question of how does the information technology affect the distribution of income and the employment of people, and are there dangers that there is an underclass of neglected people arising from it. Now, I have six of those concerns, which I'll briefly discuss today, and then I'll say something, if there's time left at the end, about one or two other issues related to these. Now, my second concern, my second nightmare, is what I call the electronic nightmare. It is, I guess, concerned with the question of privacy. How are we all affected by the fact that cheap and super efficient means of surveillance now exist? You can have a camera that is not larger than a wasp that photographs everything you do in a particular room, and you have tiny microphones that are capable of recording whispered conversations from across the street. And should we be worried by, or is there a question of privacy? And by the way, the support, the proponents and the opponents of respecting privacy or letting not being concerned about it are both on the right and the left. It is not a question that divides the political left and the right. Very fortunately, I would say, the same technologies that destroy our privacy also make it, of course, much easier to discover terrorists, to trap stalkers, to detect fraud, to prosecute criminals, and to hold the government to account. And in fact, there is a book, there's a man called David Brin, an American physicist and science fiction writer. I haven't read any of his science fiction novels, but I read his book called The Transparent Society. And he argues that we should not be concerned with preserving our privacy. We should make everything open. The question is, the problem is asymmetric privacy. That is to say that the police or the government can survey what we are doing, but we cannot survey what they are doing. Police cameras watch us, he would advocate, and we should be able to watch these police cameras. And the biggest threat to freedom is that surveillance technology will be used by too few, not by too many. That was what David Brin argues. On the other hand, of course, Amitai Etzioni, you know, the founder of the communitarian movement, sees that America has a pro-privacy bias. Now, I can see the argument. In fact, economists would support the argument by David Brin that we should not insist on privacy, but we should open up everything to everybody so that everybody can see what everybody is doing. Economists have talked recently about asymmetric information flows, which cause all sorts of problems. For instance, war can be caused by the fact that one side is guessing wrongly about the other's determination and power to fight it. Similarly, going to trial and similar problems. But most people, I guess, in America, and I think probably Amitai Etzioni is right, there is a bias. And there was a film called The Truman Show in which the hero abandons the only life he knows to evade in order to evade the pitiless gaze of the cameras, having discovered that he has been the subject of reality TV, of a reality TV show since birth. So that, very briefly, is my second concern. I don't want to take a particular view, but I leave it to you to decide what is right or wrong about privacy. The next one will take a bit longer to discuss, which is what I call the Frankenstein nightmare. You remember, of course, Mary Shelley's novel, perhaps the most influential science fiction story in existence, which was published in 1818. And it is concerned with the creation of life. In those days when Mary Shelley published her book, of course, people thought that God created life. And the subtitle of the book is The Modern Prometheus. Prometheus, of course, stole the fire from heaven and gave it to mankind. And he was punished because he gave mankind power and with it choice. Should the question of the second nightmare is concerned with, should biotechnologists be allowed to mess around with the genetic structure of human beings? And I'll be talking a little bit about genetic messing around, but also about biology and a bit about drugs, pharmacology. The dangers, of course, are obvious, and the promise of a longer life, of freedom from depression and guarantee of happiness through certain pills and pharmacological inventions, are that the costs are, the promises are obvious, the costs are less obvious. Are these psychotropic drugs, for instance, form one of the pharmacologically altered states? But I want to say a few words about the question of human cloning, which, of course, has been very much debated. I'm not sure what exactly the American position now is. I think we haven't really in America yet banned it. Many European countries have, but it's still under debate in the Senate and the House of Representatives. I guess the argument against cloning is that children should not be designed in advance, that newborns should be truly new without the burden of genetic identity. And the opposition to cloning relies heavily on the difficult-to-maintain distinction between natural and unnatural. I think we all agree that you cannot say because it's unnatural, because what is natural after all? We have given up natural in the sense of given by nature a long time ago, because the introduction of antibiotics, of vaccination, of efficient agriculture, and even the abolition of slavery can be regarded as unnatural. But the issue of cloning is whether we should allow it, whether we should control it. Of course, there is cloning for not cloning, but certain types of curing of diseases as a result of not so much cloning but genetic engineering. There is a book by Francis Fukuyama called Our Post-Human Future, and he is very much, I think, against cloning. The post-human world could be one that is far more hierarchical. One doesn't really know what kind of world clones would produce. It could produce a hierarchical society in which the elite select their highly intelligent people. For instance, if you have a parent who are 5 foot tall and bald and not very intelligent, they can have children through genetic engineering, not so much through cloning, through genetic engineering, which are 6 foot tall and which have long blonde hair and which are very intelligent, by implanting those genes that carry these qualities. And in fact, the question is whether you have an elite group of people who would be and the rest who would not benefit from this. In fact, there's Professor George Annas, who I believe is a professor here at Boston University, who said that genism could eclipse racism as the most destructive force on the planet if we have the introduction of genetic engineering. I'm not now talking only about cloning, about genetic engineering in general. And Bill McKibben, who also writes about these things, he regards genetically engineered genius, if you have the genes of a genius and you implant those on a child, he regards these as being equivalent to a robot. And it's an uncomfortable thought. But one has to ask oneself, why should we prefer naturally or haphazardly produced human beings to intentionally constructed ones through the genes, unintentionally mixed genes to planned ones, if you like? We believe that a person who has been programmed to make certain choices is not truly free, but it is odd because we can equally say that the same may be the result of accidental, haphazard influences of gene and, of course, the environment of both nature and nurture. But equally, of course, the post-human future could be one in which we had a society of equal beings, of people who have all access to the good things, compassionate, with better health care, longer lives, and more intelligence than today. Or it could be one of what Francis Fukuyama calls a softly centralized or softly planned society, like Huxley's Brave New World, a soft tyranny, he calls it. Everyone is healthy and happy, but we have forgotten the meaning of things like hope, fear, or struggle. So the question is, what kind of society would genetic engineering produce? It could, of course, be, and that would be highly desirable, that we have the opposite of the old eugenic society. You remember under the Nazis and in the eugenics, the people who were not fit were killed off, their children were killed off, and only the best were reared. But this could be the opposite of this kind of society, because we could have a society in which we enhance the situation of the under-endowed, enhance the abilities of their children, everybody would be equally wonderful. So I think that is for consideration. We don't really know what kind of society genetic engineering would produce. Perhaps more, even more worrisome to genetic engineering, if it is worrisome, and maybe, as I said, quite beneficial, is neuroscience, operation on the brains. In an attempt to treat depression, neuroscientists once carried out a simple experiment. They used electrodes and they stimulated the brains of women who were suffering from depression, and they caused pleasurable feelings, and for a time the symptoms of depression disappeared, they evaporated. But there was one drawback from some points of view. These women fell quickly in love with the experimenters. So it was more a threat to human dignity and autonomy than it was perhaps to genetic to neuroscientific interventions. It would be capable of enhancing human beings, but some worry the society will turn out to be a homogeneous mess. Everybody would be the same. So I don't think we know exactly what would happen as a result of these things, but it could be quite disastrous. In last year, in New York University, another group of experimenters attached a computer chip directly to a rat's brain. It made it possible to steer these rats just in the way you do remote-controlled toy cars in certain directions. Now, that again is a cause for concern. So can we extend the quantity of life, which, of course, is also one of the things that neuroscience can promises to do? Aubrey de Grey, who apparently is a researcher in Cambridge University, he predicts that life expectancy in the year 2100 will be 5,000 years. Of course, none of us will be around to check whether this forecast is right or wrong, but it is perhaps enjoyable or frightening to think that the question of life expectancy is another one that will be touched by genetic and neuroengineering. So the threat of an atomic eclipse, which was common in the 20th century, has now been replaced by the fear of unstoppable human-engineered viruses, rampaging mutant genes, etc. I don't really know again. You see, I don't come out on either side, but I just wanted to say it is a cause for concern, this whole question of engineering. Now, this is the third one, I think it was. Now I'm coming to the fourth concern, or the fourth question of a technological nightmare. And that is what I used to call, when I started to think about it, a terrorist's atom bomb in the suitcase. But it is more likely nowadays not to be the atom bomb in a suitcase, but the atomic bomb in one of the 2,000 steel containers that enter the United States every hour in different harbors. You know, they are, hardly any of them are opened or controlled. When I served in Britain many years ago on the Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution, one of our concerns, one of our remits was the fast breeder reactor, the atomic reactor. And there were a number of worries that the Royal Commission then had, amongst them, of course, accidents, sabotage, terrorist attacks of atomic reactors, proliferation of nuclear weapons capability. But one which I think we have talked about recently since 9/11 quite a lot has been the concern for freedom and liberty, which may be threatened by the ways, by the steps you may have to take in order to prevent these terrorists and these sabotage from taking. In order to prevent these, is our freedom threatened? To prevent attacks on nuclear station, our freedom and civil rights and, liberties may well be in danger. It is said that the Washington's global interventionism, which has recently been quite in evidence, has magnified the chances that one of the U.S. cities will become the target of mega-terrorism. Now, It is, as you know, possible to produce atom bombs very simply nowadays. And I think only 5 kilograms of weapon-grade plutonium or 15 kilograms of weapon-grade uranium are sufficient to produce one. It's less than to fill a fruit bowl. And there are 15,000 Russian nuclear warheads now in evidence. A nuclear explosion, General Alexander Lebed, a general in the Soviet army, said before the Soviet Union collapsed, had produced suitcase-sized nuclear weapons easily transported anywhere. Loose nukes can easily find their way into the hands of Al-Qaeda. As I mentioned last time, Martin Rees, the British Astronomer Royal and professor in Cambridge, wrote that the collapse of the Soviet Union has left the world awash in raw materials, enriched uranium and plutonium for some 70,000 bombs. So that is another concern and worry, which we have so far evaded, and there may be good reasons for this. It may be easier to produce conventional bombs. But from what I hear and read about this, this is certainly my fourth concern or worry about technological nightmares. A fifth concern or worry is what is called cyber terror and cyber error. It may be terror or it may be error. The largest blackout in U.S. history in August the 14th and 15th, 2003, was caused, and many people were initially worried, as you know, when it happened, that it may have been caused by terrorists or by sabotage. It wasn't, as we now know, but it is in principle possible, because terrorists could broke into the computers that control the water supply of a large American city, open and close the valves by a tick of the mouse, and contaminate the water with untreated sewage or toxic chemicals and then release it in a devastating flood. As the emergency services tried to respond, these terrorists would strike again and shut down the telephone network and electrical power grid with just a few mouse clicks. Now, that is one possibility. But against that, I'm told that this is very complicated, that it would take a long time to prepare, it would take $200 million to finance, and that therefore we are going to be spared for a while this kind of attack on the infrastructure, on the information infrastructure, on the internet, and causing software glitches in this way. So I don't really know whether this is another thing to worry about, but I'm just putting it on the list of technological possible nightmares which might happen. Next, there is what I call, and that I'm very ignorant about, I'm sure that many of you know much more about it, I call it our final experiment. In order to make experiments, physicists want to accelerate atoms close to the speed of light and then crash them together. Some physicists raise the possibility that these experiments could start a chain reaction that might destroy not only us in this room, but the whole Earth, and perhaps even tearing the fabric of space, the whole universe. I've just been reading another science fiction novel by Greg Brenford called Cosm, in which actually he doesn't destroy, but he creates a universe. She creates a universe, actually. But there is a very tiny risk. The question is this. What do you do if you have a very, very small risk of a very calamitous outcome, of a very bad outcome? Low probability, high cost catastrophes. And I'll come to one of the problems that some environmentalists try to persuade us to adopt, which is the precautionary principle. At the end of my talk, I'll say a few words about this. But there are three possibilities in our final experiment. One is a black hole, which sucks in everything around it, which is created by this atomic acceleration. The second are quarks. Each proton and neutron consists of three quarks and reassemble themselves into a compressed object called a strangelet. I'm really out of my depth, but this is what I read about. And it transforms everything it encounters into a strange form of matter. Another novel that I have recently read, Kurt Vonnegut's novel called Cat's Cradle, deals with such a substance called Ice Nine. A strangely disaster, and Ice Nine transforms the whole world and freezes all the oceans and transforms into solid state at room temperature, not at particularly low temperatures. A stranger disaster could transform the entire planet Earth into an inert, hyperdense sphere about 100 meters across. And thirdly, a catastrophe that engulfs space itself. When particles crash together, they could trigger a phase transition, as it is called by physicists, I believe, that would rip the fabric of space itself. So I did depend on the physicists amongst you to know the answer to these and how likely it is. But even if it is very unlikely, but if it is a disastrous outcome, it is worth, of course, weighing the costs against the benefits. These, I think, are the six nightmares, technological nightmares, that I wanted you to consider, that we should discuss a little bit. But let me raise some other questions related to these. One, of course, is the question of the accountability of political representatives, of the politicians. This has recently been very much less discussed. But as the technology that we command becomes more arcane and specialized, political decisions require training and understanding confined to a very small circle of the technical experts. What missile system to choose, or something nearer my expertise, what exchange rate to choose, or whether to leave the exchange rate to the market forces, is a question which it is not easy to take votes on, which the people in general would know. It takes experts to know the answer to this question. Now, does technocracy have to replace democracy, or can we keep the technocrats under political control? Or are we to be delivered what C. Wright Mills called technological crackpots? It is a question, again, which I want to raise rather than answer. Let me ask another question. That is, should Prometheus be constrained or restrained? On the whole, subject to some important exceptions, of course, in the weapons field and even in the cloning, the view of scientists, and perhaps even of many non-scientists, if it can be done, it should be done. We should do it. Should we try or slow down or halt the technical progress? Technological progress. There are some reasons which I think would command that we should not do that. For instance, on a much smaller scale than the technological nightmares I've discussed, if international trade is involved, each country has to be at the frontiers, and perhaps you wouldn't want to halt it. Or if it is a question of defending ourselves against enemies, again, there would be perhaps no constraint and it should go anywhere. But let us assume these two constraints, international trade and defense, away. Let us assume there is a genuine international control of weapons of mass destruction. Should progress, technical progress, be controlled? Economists apply it to almost everything else, cost-benefit analysis. You weigh the costs against the benefits. But on the whole, technical progress has not been subjected to a cost-benefit analysis, at least as far as I've thought. For instance, there are many technical inventions that knock out the exports of developing countries, like synthetic products and similar inventions. Yet, the costs that these inflict on the developing countries as a result of cutting off their exports and impoverishing them are never considered. When it can be done, it should be done. There are really two questions involved. You may say, first of all, can technological progress be controlled? and should it be controlled? In spite of opinion to the contrary, I think it can be controlled. We can, in principle, control technical progress. And the current mood, of course, is against government control, but the speed and the scope of technological development can, in principle, be controlled. We have controlled, to some extent, nuclear weapons and nuclear power, ballistic missiles, biological and chemical warfare agents, and others. There used to be a U.S. Office of Technology Assessment, which, in my view, until 1995, when it was abolished, which I think did very good work in assessing the value and the lack of value, the disvalue of certain types of technology. But for some reason, which I could never understand, it was closed down in 1995. Other countries like France and Holland have imitated. Britain, I think, has rejected that kind of thing. So that I would suggest that one should want to have some kind of control of technology. But let us ask now, let us talk a little bit about the so-called precautionary principle, which has been very popular amongst environmentalists. There are, I guess, two attitudes to technological progress. One is the precautionary principle, and the other one is what you might call the libertarian or perhaps libertarian is not quite the word, but the non-precautionary principle. Precautionary principle, is, as I understand it, means that when there is any risk of a major disaster of a technology appearing, no action should be permitted that increases that risk. Or else you may simply ascertain that faced with the possibility, however remote, of some catastrophic outcome, some catastrophic development, the prudent policy demands that whatever action is required to prevent it be taken. Now, I think that this precautionary principle is mistaken because it suggests that you should accept whatever costs, however high, in order to avoid this disastrous outcome. What one has to do, it seems to me, as economists always tend to do, to weigh the costs against the benefits. And if the costs exceed the benefits, you should not accept the precautionary principle. Wilfred Beckerman, I think, used the example of, we all used bicycles in Oxford, you know, and when he had a bicycle, he used to buy a lock to prevent it from being stolen. But when we buy a padlock to prevent our bicycle from being stolen, we compare the value of the bicycle with the chances of theft and the costs of the padlock. If the bicycle is worthless and the cost of the padlock is very high, we don't buy the lock. The same applies to things on a larger scale. It means what accepting the precautionary principle would really mean that irrespective of the chances of future loss, the scale of loss and the costs of preventing it, one must incur these costs of preventing the disaster's outcome. We have a choice between accepting some remote and unquantifiable possibility of possibly severe effects and the certain catastrophe if draconian policies are accepted now to avoid it. And that, I think, is nonsensical. Perhaps the extreme view, the extreme example, the extreme version of the precautionary principle, of course, is Pascal's wager, which you all know is whether you should or should not believe in the existence of God. And according to the precautionary principle, you clearly should, because if you don't believe, if you do believe, but God doesn't exist, one possibility, well, you've made a mistake, and the worst that's happened is that you are wrong. But if God exists and you don't believe in him, then you are condemned to eternal damnation, which, of course, is the worst that can happen to anybody. And therefore, Pascal's wager consists in saying that you must believe in God. So that's the extreme form of the precautionary principle. That concludes, on the whole, what I wanted to say about electronic nightmares. But I wanted to say something else about a point that was made about the Bahá'í Center I think when it was set up in the Wall Street Journal, it was announced, and center it says here, each year the center will invite visiting professors, of whom I'm one, I'm happy to say and very grateful, who have a unique vision of the distant future to lecture. One question, this is the last sentence in this Wall Street Journal article, one question the center may consider is whether there are physical limits to the ability of humans to absorb information. And I want to say a word about that, which is related in a way to the technological nightmares. It is not very strictly related to them. But it is about the limits, not the limits to growth. You remember the name of the first Club of Rome report, the limits to knowledge, a subsequent Club of Rome report, and perhaps the limits of time, which I'll say something about in a moment. In order to introduce that subject, we must ask the question: the fact that natural resources are inputs into the economy are finite, does this impose a limit on sustainable development? So-called sustainable development has become a very fashionable term, which I don't myself like very much, but let us adopt it for the moment. Now, the pessimists and the optimists are divided on this: whether the fact that natural resources are inputs and are limited. Some natural resources are limited, not all, of course. Optimists are divided. The optimists think that there will always be new ways of extracting natural resources. There will be substitutes invented for them, and there will always be ways of making up for the loss of exhaustible resources. And that, on the whole, the optimists have been proved right so far, because we have not run out of inputs into the process of technological progress. The pessimists, of course, say that if you have to use some natural resources in conjunction with human or technical resources, technical inventions, then there will come a point when exhaustible resources will be exhausted, when growth will have to come to an end. Natural resources and human capital, according to pessimists, are always interdependent and complementary. They have to go together. Now, let us assume, and knowledge, of course, can appear in three forms, as you know. It can be either unembodied, that is only embodied in blueprints or designs or books or articles. It can be embodied in equipment, in machinery, or it can be embodied in human beings, in teachers and researchers and so on. Knowledge is embodied in people through education has shown two opposite trends. On the one hand, new technological revolutions have simplified some jobs and made them easier to conduct. That is the advantage, and that means that time is not a limit. But others require more education and higher skills, other forms of technical knowledge. Production technology become ever more complex. So the question now is, since our lifespans are limited, the question now is, does the finite knowledge that people can create, absorb and apply, does that ultimately set a limit, a more serious limit to growth than the finite stock of oil or the capacity of the atmosphere to absorb carbon dioxide? The workforce, of clearly, if the requirements of knowledge are such that they become more sophisticated, more difficult, if they take more time to absorb, to invent, to acquire, and to absorb and to practice, then we know that there is a limit to the use of this knowledge and the application of this knowledge, which is given by time. Eventually, we run out of time, even if there are no physical limits to exhaustible resources, and if there are no physical limits to knowledge. And even now, already, there is a large amount of knowledge, which there's more information available than knowledge, and perhaps more knowledge than wisdom, and the question is it perhaps, as this last sentence in the Wall Street Journal article, is it perhaps time that sets a limit to our technical progress rather than either natural resources or other forms of economic constraints? I think that really concerns all that I wanted to say, and we'll have time for you to supplement or detract from what I've said and to ask questions and to make additional remarks. Thank you very much.
A member of our faculty has proposed that legislation should be enacted, setting up appropriate regulatory bodies which would regulate scientific inquiry and experimentation on the theory that these technological nightmares of which you speak are so close at hand that some sort of regulation ought to take place in all prudence. What do you think?
Well, I would agree with that. And I'm out of fashion, I realize that, because the fashion at the moment is to minimize government regulation. And I think I've learned the fact that governments don't always necessarily do good. You see, when I was a student, many of these questions take me back to my student days. There used to be a view that government can do no wrong. There were people like Pigou, the welfare economist, and James Mead, who thought that if anything goes wrong in the economy, you have, if there are market failures, as economists call them, you have the government step in and you correct it, and that is the answer. Nowadays, of course, people think that government can do no right, and government must never step in, must never do anything. And I think they are equally wrong. I think I've learned that to trust government to regulate is not necessarily the first best solution. But equally to say that everything must be left to private enterprise and the market is not necessarily the first best solution either. So I would come out somewhere in between. One has to take each one. It depends very much on how various institutions in the country, how the government itself is formed, how the civil service, the support of the government is formed, whether there is an uncorrupt, relatively uncorrupt civil service. And in principle, I would say that while now being much more aware than I was when I was a student of the danger of government, in principle, government regulation must step in, and as it already has, of course, in most civilized countries, to avoid some of the manifestations of some of these technological nightmares that I've been talking about. I don't know how you, I'm sure that different views would be held amongst you, but I think that we have passed the extreme view that government can do no right, and we are now approaching some intermediate form where we say that government regulation, government intervention, in case of market failures, is justified when certain conditions are given. I mean, it is very obviously the case that when the market fails, this is not obviously an argument for government intervention. It may be that the second best is done by the market. But very few people remember that it also works the other way around. When government fails, this is not necessarily an argument for markets, because markets may be doing even worse, like monopolies in privatization. So I would say, yes, I would be on the side of your colleague who advocates that.
I wondered whether it would be a nightmare if the United States, which might have the ability to do it, made it national policy to not just slow down our technology, but to regulate the entire world's technology, just as we have now stated that we will regulate weapons of mass destruction, including whatever action is needed. We will assure that no nation establishes a military that could compete with ours. We probably now have the power to destroy anyone who tries to create or promote a technology that we don't want to be developed. As an example, this might be a very cost-effective way of dealing with military costs. For example, I know that at MIT they are developing a quantum computer. No one knows how to make this. The military is spending millions of dollars to fund this only because they want to make sure that no one else can develop it unless we have it. Probably they will never be able to build a quantum computer, but this is defensive. It would be much cheaper if we had a policy, much more cost-effective, of somehow preventing other people from developing quantum computers and not doing it ourselves. Can you imagine, or would you consider this a nightmare, if we made it a policy to prohibit the world from having technology that we don't have and we don't want?
Well, let me ask you a question. Of course, it isn't. I mean, it depends on what institution would control this. But
the United States government, not a world institution.
But you see, did you know about this Office of Technology Assessment, which I thought did very good work in assessing the consequences?
It was run by Congress.
It was independent, I believe. It was independent of any. It was set up, of course, by the government. It was subsidized by the government, but it was in its composition and views. And so on. It was not responsive.
I might be wrong, but I think it was partisan. I think it was established by Congress to advise them, and it kept, because it was established by Congress and accountable to Congress, it kept giving them advice that was what Congress wanted and often not what the White House wanted. I think that was it. That's one of the problems, I think, that whoever pays for it is going to get the answers that they probably want.
Well, my impression, and that is not very deep, is that they were independent in their judgment, and they made some very good assessments of certain types of technology, good and bad, and they were not controlled by politicians, but I may be wrong. And I think, as I said, Holland and France, I believe, or Belgium, or one of these countries, have them, and they seem to be working quite well. No, I wouldn't like them to be directly controlled, or even indirectly controlled by politicians. That would be disastrous.
But that could conceivably happen, and that would, I presume, be a nightmare.
Yeah.
But it's a possibility that just occurs to me.
So you would be in favor of any scientist, technology should always go ahead, subject to, of course, some things like atomic energy and so on, of uncontrolled scientific progress?
I'm not sure.
About 3 weeks ago, the British government made an announcement that those universities wishing to raise fees would have to open their doors to less talented people, in other words.
Sorry?
Those who would normally not gain access to British universities would have to be admitted in order to enable universities to raise fees. In other words, enforced equality done by a government. What actually is wrong with this idea? We already know that enough unqualified people do populate our universities.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch what you said. What did they do?
All right, I'll start somewhere else. I'll be brief, though. You mentioned Kurt Vonnegut, who has offered the solution, and my question will be, what do you actually object to in his suggestion, as voiced in the novel or novella Harrison Bergeron, where one particular gadfly or maverick, a very smart man, IQ about 140, is thinking all these smart thoughts that do not find the approval of the government. So a little receiver is installed in his brain, and every 10 seconds a signal disrupts his line of thinking. This would be indeed the height of enforced equality. If we all had such a little receiver in our brains, we could be very well controlled and established on a level acceptable to the governments. What's wrong with that?
I would have... I'm not sure that I fully heard. I think I would have understood. I would reward, and I would have differences which are attributable to effort, but not necessarily to... you think that would be an implantation in the brain that would make everybody equal?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, in a way, you see, I mean, if you can improve and make everybody a genius, I think that would be quite desirable, quite a good thing. One point I didn't make, but I would have liked to make in terms of, say, controlling the Promethean instinct, why not channel it into or allow it to flourish in other lines than science and technology? If you look at the amount of money that is spent by the government on this, compared, say, with the arts, with architecture, with painting, with music, it is very large and the others are rather neglected. There are many ways in which you can manifest your Promethean instinct other than simple science and technology. And the IQs may be quite... The IQs, as we know, measure only one dimension. There are many dimensions to it, which one wants to encourage.
In choosing your nightmares,
yeah,
you chose things, first of all, specifically that are like engineering, I guess, medical, science, whatever, but less process-oriented or sort of organizational.
Yeah.
Improvements in sort of organizational or management technology. And you also chose things that are very sort of fantastic, nightmares that are sort of outrageous, fantastic, but which are also highly improbable. And so I'm wondering if we should also be concerned with nightmares that are perhaps less fantastic, but more probable.
What would you mention, for instance?
So I was thinking about this whole sort of rise of prisons and the imprisonment of an enormous, you know, portion of our population. And I was thinking about Michel Foucault's book, Discipline and Punish, which is a very sort of systematic study of the transformation of thinking in how we punish people and respond to crime.
Yes, no, I think that's right. I think, well, we can each one of us draw up our own lists of nightmares, and we can then perhaps have a discussion of the respective likelihood, probabilities, and what to do about them. But I agree. Mine were mainly taken from science and technology, and you were saying organization and other forms of nightmares could be constructed. I agree. And I think that maybe next time the Pardee Center invites me, I'll do another list. Thank you.
You've been listening to Professor Paul Streeton in the second of his two lectures, together entitled Technological Nightmares. Join us next week as we present the first of three lectures given by Nobel Peace Prize winner Professor Elie Wiesel. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by John Corradi and Matt Largy, with help from Boris Strapotsky. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us. Last year, WBUR's first ever public radio gala was a sold-out celebration of public radio. The event was unforgettable. On November 13th, join NPR and WBUR luminaries for this year's gala, hosted by NPR's Robert Siegel and honoring veteran journalist Daniel Shore.
I think that if Ed Murrow were alive today, he would be with us at public radio. It's about, for a journalist, the only place to be.
Don't miss this year's chance to join your favorite public radio personalities in honoring Daniel Shore. Call 800-909-9287.